You're listening to Homicide Worldwide. Your host, Sally Ankita, would like to remind our listeners the episodes deal with crimes that are graphic in nature and may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
For joining us here tonight at Homicide Worldwide Podcast. A quick shout out to all the folks who are supporting us by listening every week. We are so grateful to you all. If there is a case that you would like to hear us talk about, please email suggestions to homicideworldwidepodcast@gmail.com and we will get to that as soon as we can. Please follow us on social media, on Instagram and Twitter at Homicide Worldwide Podcast. And finally, please keep telling your friends about us because it really helps our show. We hope you enjoy it this evening. We'll see you back next week. Humans are, to put it simply, complicated. We are mysterious, wonderful, and also a terrible biological phenomenon. One that has the ability to feel an absurd range of emotions and feelings, and we have billions and billions of thoughts throughout our lifespan that most of the time don't add up to the sum of their parts. When our amazing emotions, feelings, and thoughts come together in a constructive way, we can do things like go into space or create skyscrapers that defy logic. But when they collide with each other, like a dreaded asteroid plummeting into the Earth one of these days, that will wipe out our hubris human race, that is a terrifying place to be indeed. Edmund Kemper III could have lived his young life in the former with a staggering IQ, but unfortunately for his 10 victims, he moved into the latter at the age of 15 and has been residing there ever since. His rage and years of abuse that he alleges his mother inflicted upon him finally came to a boiling point when he killed her and her friend, but it had been years in the making. He had killed before, but they were not his ultimate target. Instead, they were ill-fated interactions, moments in time that turned into practice runs for the woman he really wanted to destroy. We are taking a trip back to everyone's favorite American Twilight era, the 1970s, when Edmund Kemper's dark thoughts, emotions, feelings, and fantasy of murdering his very own mother, Clarnell, finally came to fruition. In his final closing argument, his public defender quite rightly said of his client, "There are two people locked up in the body of this young giant, one good and one evil. One is fighting to be here with us, and the other one is slipping off into his own little world of fantasy where he is happy." This is episode 20 of Homicide Worldwide. Sally.
Good evening.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm really glad to be here with you.
Yay.
And Ed.
Yes.
Ed Kemper. First, if you have not been here before with us, we are Homicide Worldwide, and my name is Sally. I am one of your co-hosts.
And I am Kita, the other co-host.
The other one of the co-hosts. Yes. But we are two co-hosts.
But we make up one giant co-host together. If you matched our bodies together, yes, it would just be one co-host. But we'd each keep our own head.
We can make this work with our Thelma and Louise fantasy somehow. We just need to get a bench seat in the car so that our whole body cells can fit in. Okay, we're going too far. We are very happy to be here with you for our 20th episode.
I know. It feels like...
Can you believe?
I can't believe. But yet we're here.
Yes. We want to dedicate this episode to our producer. He does all the parts that we don't want to / are not capable of doing.
Yes.
So put myself in the incompetent at technology pile.
Yes. So this is dedicated to our wonderful producer.
This is for you. We are very excited to talk about Ed Kemper. Some of you may already know a little about Ed Kemper, especially if you have been a fan of a show on Netflix called Mindhunter, which kind of explores the birth of criminal psychology as we know it today, mm-hmm. and how profiling works and the FBI Behavioral Science Unit. One of the people that these FBI investigators who were kind of birthing this new science, the most illuminating conversations that they had were with Ed Kemper, who at this point was and still is incarcerated.
Yes.
Ed Kemper likes to talk. And how?
Ed Kemper's favorite subject is Ed Kemper.
It is.
He does enjoy
so much to talk about. He does.
His own stories. His own brand of murder is his favorite kind of murder.
It's true.
You know, it's interesting to go back to what you were saying, though, about Mindhunter. The guy who played him was literally could not have been cast better.
Cameron something. If you're listening, Cameron, you only need one name.
Exactly. That's awesome. Exactly. So here we are talking about Ed Kemper. He's so interesting on so many levels. For me, not in the same way as other serial killers or just crime in general. Like, he's just, he's so, as you put it when we were talking about it, he's so self-aware.
He has something that a lot of them don't have. First of all, he's very unique in that they caught him alive. And so they can study him.
Yes.
And unlike some of the other serial killers, they didn't kill him.
Like Dr. Chilton in The Silence of the Lambs. So rare to capture one alive.
The way he says it with that slimy slime.
He's so
slimy.
Terrible.
The actor's fantastic, though, because he just makes you detest him.
Yeah, you really do.
But they're unicorns, especially when you get one who not only is intelligent enough and, I guess, self-reflective enough to speak very clearly and lucidly about mm-hmm. what he did, but is also willing to talk.
Right, because so many of them want to be withholding.
They get off on being.
They get off on, it's because it's a power thing, right? And like mm-hmm. for him, the way he approached it was, these crimes have to stop, and I'm the only one who can put a stop to them. And once he was captured, if you have ears and the ability to hear, he will tell you all about it. When I was looking into some of the documentaries, it's like rare footage. I'm like, what the fuck's rare about this? Like, the only rare thing is for him to stop talking about himself. So, but anyway,
that's the unusual part. Ed Kemper was born a little after World War II finished. He was born on December 18th, 1948 in Burbank, California.
Yes.
He was the middle child to Clarnell and Edmund Emil Kemper II.
Yes.
So Ed Kemper's full name was Edmund Emil Kemper III.
Yes.
And there's also an Edmund Emil Kemper I, who we will talk about in just a little while.
Yes. So many Edmunds.
Spoiler, he gets shot and killed. I don't want to give it away, but I just did. So there's that. So we've got this little family. Ed is the middle child. He's got an older sister and a younger sister. So he's kind of bookended by women. He has a lot of women in his life who are trying to kind of control him and are not particularly nice to him. So his dad had fought in World War II. We don't know what that was like for him. And there's not a ton of information that I can find about dad. He later was part of the nuclear weapons tests in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that he said, so his parents did not have a happy marriage. It was a fabulous quote.
It was so good.
So it's just, this is a recurring theme that we're going to see.
Yeah.
Unhappy marriages. It reminded me a lot of Dahmer's parents' marriage, of just like a lot of conflict.
Yeah. But these people had the good sense to call it quits.
They did. And they didn't wait freaking 18 years to do it.
Yeah.
So Edmund II, otherwise known as Ed Kemper's dad, said this about Ed's mom, Clarnell. He said, "Suicide missions in wartime and the atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with her."
Like, how do you come back from that? You can't.
It's basically suicide and nuclear bombs are better than Clarnell. So Ed Kemper's dad was a very large man. I believe he was 6'5". Mm-hmm. His mom, Clarnell, was also a very large lady.
Like at 6 feet, right?
6 feet tall and 225. Apparently, she didn't carry it as fat. It was just brawn. She was just a big, strong lady.
Yes.
She wasn't ashamed of using it either. She used her physicality to kind of dominate.
Yeah. You can kind of see it just from the picture. Like, she was a really intimidating looking person.
And intimidating is the word that Ed used often to describe her, that he was afraid of her, terrorized by her, intimidated by her. So when he was young, he was a very large baby. He was a very large toddler. He was just large his whole life.
I read 12 to 13 pounds. A couple of different sources referenced 12 to 13 pounds as a fucking newborn. No wonder she was mad at him.
I know, I'd be mad. You know, destroyed my junk.
Literally. Yeah.
What is it from Family Guy, like throwing a sausage down a hallway?
Yeah, hot dog down a hallway.
Hot dog down a hallway. Wow. Sorry, everybody. So he had two sisters. The older sister is Susan, and the younger sister is Allen, spelled A-L-L-Y-N, mm-hmm. the female version of Allen. He was a big kid. He really stood out. Unsurprisingly, he got a lot of crap from a lot of people about his size. He was a person who didn't want to stand out. He wanted to blend in. He didn't want to be a misfit. And that was physically, literally impossible because of his just immense size.
I never really understand. The last person I'm going to be teasing is somebody who's way bigger than me.
That's right.
Like,
unless you know for a fact they're not going to fight back. That's why if you get bullied, you kind of have to fight back or they just keep doing it.
This is Homicide Worldwide telling you to fight it out.
Don't back down and don't use this against us in court.
Yeah, exactly.
A couple of things that Ed did, as well as being very big, was he was really into messing with animals in a way that we here at Homicide Worldwide do not like.
We don't
like it.
I threaten my cat on a daily basis. Anybody with a cat can relate, I'm sure. So with the cat situation, we'll briefly go over this because I think most people who listen to this don't really want to hear this part either. Mm-mm. Ed really enjoyed, one of his favorite things to do was to sort of dismember his sister's dolls and really dismember them. Like, this was arms, this was legs, and his favorite, the head. And he was very young when he was doing this, like 8 or younger. And this graduated into the cat, the first cat, which he buried alive and then dug up and decapitated. And that's all I'm going to say about that. He did have one other run-in with a cat. He felt the cat was somehow giving more attention to his sister. If you've ever had a cat, they don't play favorites. They don't care. They don't give a fuck about who you are. They're the most aloof creatures on the planet. But apparently to Ed Kemper, this cat was favoring his sister, and so he dealt with this cat much in the same way. There's a few other details with that, but I'm not going to go into those details because they're really bothersome. But I will talk about the murder of other people. Definitely talk about that.
We'll talk about that. There's one more instance of sort of messing with animals that gives a little insight into his character. And it was actually recounted by his cousin, Patricia Kemper. And this is in a letter that she wrote to the parole board at one of his parole hearings, and she was urging them to deny him parole.
Yeah.
In the letter, she said that when he was a child, she watched him one day. There was like a hole where he knew a squirrel lived, and he stood by the hole for several hours with a gun that he had, waiting to blow its head off when it peeked out, which is what he did. I mean, it was a quick death, as squirrel deaths go. But still, like, that's the kind of person that we're dealing with here. He's very patient, he's very brutal, and he digs suffering.
It's definitely something that he gets a lot of enjoyment out of that.
That's right. He also had some fun childhood games that he played with his sisters. This is kind of, again, indicative of the fantasy life, because when children create games, it's often kind of an offshoot of their fantasy. So if you're into Star Wars, then your fantasy is, you know, running around on the playground. I'm Darth Vader, you're Luke Skywalker, etc.
I would be Chewbacca.
I didn't say make that sound. I can't make my throat like vibrate enough. I got to be Chewbacca.
You learned that trick
Yeah, you did. You vibrate a lot. Anyway, so some fantasy, speaking of fantasy games, so the fantasy games that he would play with his sisters involved play acting of executions. One of them was called Gas Chamber.
The other one was called Electric Chair.
Woohoo! Oh, children and their merry childhood
games. Their fertile imaginations.
Exactly. And they're pretty much what you would imagine them to be. They pretended to tie him to an electric chair, and then one of them would somberly flip this pretend switch and he would
the executioner
in agony. I love that one of the sisters was the executioner. It's hilarious.
It is kind of funny.
And same thing with Gas Chamber. He would be strapped to a chair, or they would put him in a room and then they would quote lock it, and then they would flip a fake switch and he would pretend that he was choking on noxious gases and dying.
Yeah, so he would act them out. Like you said, he would writhe around and he'd do the whole like body convulsion and if that was the electric chair, or he would with the breathing in of the gas. Like, it was apparently quite realistic for young kids.
I believe it. I bet he was a fantastic actor. He also had several near-death experiences as a child.
Also somewhat relating back to his sister.
Amazing, right? One time, Susan, that's the older sister, the older of the two sisters, she tried to push him in front of an oncoming train. Wow.
There was something with the Kemper children.
Something with the Kemper children that's not quite right. Yeah. And another time, the same sister, Susan, that apparently they really didn't get along, she tried to push him into a swimming pool and he actually came pretty close to drowning.
Yeah, it was the deep end of the pool, which... Yeah. He was so tall. I'm very confused as to how that could have happened. I don't know.
Right. He's like, and he stands up and it comes up.
Yeah, exactly.
We can tease him. It's okay.
It's a foot bath.
Yeah, it's a foot bath.
Anyways.
So a real kind of a screwed up childhood. He had a crappy relationship with his mother pretty much from the start.
Yeah.
There was a lot of disparaging, a lot of name calling. She gave him so much crap about his size. As he got older, it was things like, no one's ever going to want you. What woman would ever want you? Stuff like this is awful things.
And that was all after their divorce. Because prior to the divorce, it was bad, but it wasn't as bad as it was going to get.
He was also made from the age of about 8. He was made to sleep in the basement. He recounts this story, which is pretty freaking scary if you imagine being an 8-year-old, about what it was like for him to sleep in the basement. So the basement spanned the entire length of the house. It was very, very long. And you walk down these rickety stairs and there is like one light.
Yeah.
And you have to turn that light on and it barely penetrates the darkness.
It's like every basement in your nightmares.
That's right, exactly. Like, you can just imagine the hand coming up between the floor.
The open stairs.
And so he had to basically walk into the darkness, away from the light, into this dark, dark, dark basement to find the next light switch was all the way down the other end. I was like, why don't you just bring a flashlight, dumbass? But that's okay. That's
get a floor lamp, pal.
Floor lamp, anything. But this is 8-year-old. Maybe he just wasn't very creative. Maybe the IQ really kicked in a little later.
A little later. He was preoccupied with execution games.
Trying to like find the light switch in the dark. So eventually he finds that one, and then he has to go back and turn off the first one. And then he's got the light that's near his bed. So this is something he had to do every night. Apparently Clarnell insisted that he keep the door shut, and she often locked him in because she was afraid that he was going to do something possibly sexual to his sisters. I don't know where she got that idea from. It's a pretty specific idea to have about your 8-year-old son.
It's such a young age. Mm-hmm. You know, I could see if he was like, 13 or 14 and had been like creeping around, like, I'm not condoning locking him in the basement. I'm just saying obviously like that would be a little bit more like, okay, maybe I need to keep an eye on this kid, but fucking 8, really? Mm-hmm. What could he have done at 8 years old? Any 8-year-old kid, really?
That's right. Not very much.
Well, I don't know. He was playing those games, so I don't know. Maybe I don't know what I'm talking about.
You know, this relationship with his mom, where she was very, very domineering. By his own admission, he was kind of a little shit as a child. At school, his teachers regarded him as very obedient, almost to the point of being meek. And they used the word meek. I think it was odd for them, given his size, that he would be so meek.
Yeah, meek wouldn't be the word that... It's not like, that word association game. Like, meek wouldn't come to mind.
especially with what he gets up to later, but that was how he was perceived by his teachers. He was seen as very intelligent, didn't always apply himself.
Yeah, he was kind of a shitty student. Did you read about how he had a crush on his second grade teacher?
Oh, tell me about this.
Oh, okay. So he has this crush on his second grade teacher. Apparently, one of his sisters, who I would only assume to be Susan because she seems like a real instigator kid. Also, she's passed away, so I don't really want to speak ill of the dead. She seemed like she was kind of an instigator with him. Said to him at one point, "Why don't you just kiss her?" His response was, "If I kiss her, I'd have to kill her first."
What?
Yeah.
Why?
He was all into the necrophilia as an adult.
Do you think that's little like proto-necrophilia tendencies even as a child?
I think that there was a lot going on there and that there were probably a lot of tells with him and nobody was looking out for that kind of thing at the time. Because this was the 60s. You know, people just, and even if they were looking out for things like that, nobody was talking about it, you know.
And there weren't resources really. There weren't many. I mean, it was still in its infancy, this whole idea of like, you know, family therapy and anything like that.
But. Yeah, it really was. So, but after his parents divorced, they move out to Montana, a beautiful state. We love you, Montana. Yeah, it's really nice. And anyway, they move out to Montana. It's Helena, the capital, and his mother is really escalating in her abuse with him. Like at this point, he's even taller. He really reminds her a lot of Edmund II, his dad, and who she just despises with every fiber in her 6 foot tall woman body. And she turns that rage onto Edmund, her son, and is just, she's verbally abusive. She's always talking about how nobody's going to love him and nobody's going to want him. No girls are ever going to talk with him. And, you know, this is all the things that you really don't want to be saying to a boy hitting puberty or anybody at all, really, but especially somebody who's coming into such a, like a tender age in life where you're already really confused about life as it is. And so she's just really constantly after him, really abusive with everything that she says to him. She wouldn't show him any kind of affection because her reasoning, this is not my words, everybody, this is her reasoning. She did not want to turn him into a gay man because she felt that if she gave him love and affection, that that would make him sensitive. And in her eyes,
that's not how it works.
You stupid ass. But in her eyes and in her twisted world, that was her answer to have her son not turn out to be gay. Either which way, he didn't, and it wouldn't have mattered if he had, but that was what she wanted to not have happen. That's sad. So he was pining after this affection that he was never going to get from his mother. And his, you know, his sisters are playing these games. Like his one sister's trying to kill him now twice. and so they've
just
played
little childhood games.
Yeah, you know, and all these things add up. He's, you know, he lives the majority of his young life in a basement with the door locked. And so around the age of like 14 or so, 15, he decides, he's like, I've had it. I'm out. I'm done with Montana. I'm done with my mom. Fuck you all. Takes off. And he goes back to his roots in California, where his dad was now living with his new wife. They were in Van Nuys. He was just living his life. The stepmom was not into having Edmund III with them. She did not want any part of him. Apparently, she felt very uneasy when he was around. Like,
well, I wonder why.
Yeah, evidently he would do things like he would go up to like where the drapes. You know, this is back in the day when people had big, heavy drapes in the house, and he would take them and kind of just slowly close them and be like, it's too much light in here. And he would do these like very odd behaviors that they were really off-putting to her. And so, you know, after a while, he'll say that she didn't want him around and that his presence would give her migraines. That's when his dad, Edmund II, says, you got to split, pal. And he sends Edmund to go and live with his grandparents, his paternal grandparents, up in a town called North Fork, California, which is about 40 miles or so from Yosemite.
And this is Maud Kemper.
This is Maud Kemper.
And this is Edmund Kemper
Senior.
The first.
Yes.
It's also good to know about what is happening in his head at this time. And so he's kind of in the middle of puberty. He's about 14 at this point, 14, 15 years old. And Edmund Kemper, in his jailhouse interviews, he talks a lot about what it was like for him in his teens, and that he was just having these, starting to have these really violent, violent thoughts.
Yeah.
That he was thinking about murder a lot. He was thinking about violence a lot. And as many boys do when they are that age, he was thinking about sex a lot.
Yeah.
And it reminds me so much of, well, Bundy especially, about how the sex and the violence really came together and melded. It really did seem that he was starting to kind of devolve at this point into this very interior mind, where so much was going on inside his mind, but he presented this very calm, very reserved exterior.
Yeah.
Except with his mom. They would have these blazing fights. What she did to him very much was verbal and emotional abuse, and sometimes physical. She would get physical with him. He talked about how she was around men, how she was around other men, and that she would really instigate and push and call out their masculinity and their manhood and be like, oh, you're not going to hit a woman? What are you going to do? You're not going to hit a woman? Stuff like this. It's like, that's a way to get yourself hit. But he talks about a lot about these horrific, vicious, vicious verbal battles they had. At one point, this is a quote from him, I've never been in such a vicious verbal battle with anyone. The level of vitriol that they spewed at each other was just enormous. It was a very toxic relationship.
I think about, like, for Clarnell, that's her son. You know, regardless of whatever happened with you and your ex-husband, like, that's your kid. What is wrong with you? Like, how does this even happen? The two of them just fed off of each other.
She was using him kind of as a focus for her anger towards men. He would often say that, and this is another quote from him, she was there to beat me. She was there to humiliate me. She was there to use me as an example of how inferior men are.
Mm-hmm.
So he was almost like a proxy for her hatred of all men.
Yeah, she just sort of seemed like she really hated males for whatever her reasoning behind. I didn't find a lot about her in that way, as far as, like, you know, was there something that had happened in her life that created that feeling for her? You know, was there any kind of, like, sexual abuse or any abuse at all? I didn't really find a lot that was, I thought, was any kind of credible source. And so we don't really know.
It always made me think that because she seemed so certain that Ed might do something to his sisters, and that's why he got locked in the basement.
Yeah.
At night, perhaps that was as a result of something that happened to her in her own childhood.
Like, she was just taking a proactive step to ensure that it didn't happen to her two daughters.
Yeah. And that's the only thing I can think of that it kind of really explains that.
Yeah.
Unless she had seen him do something that really made her believe that.
Yeah. But there's nothing that really supports that. So it's,
no, there's not.
Yeah. I don't know. I would lean toward that. But, you know, this is, again, me not knowing what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, So then, at the age of 15, as he's living with his paternal grandparents, Maud and Edmund, he really, really hates his grandmother. He doesn't seem to have a problem with his grandfather at all. Again, we see he's pretty partial to the male counterpart of the relationship. But Maud is not having it with Edmund. Apparently, he described her as well as domineering, which does sort of make me have to kind of take a step back for a second and say, like, do you just find all women domineering? And because it seems to be a really, like, a go-to way to describe women in his life. And, you know, maybe she was just strong. Maybe she wasn't going to put up with his bullshit. Maybe even his own mother to some degree, too. On August 27th, 1964, he decided that he was going to put an end to the problem of Maud. He walked up behind her as she sat at the kitchen table, and he shot her in her head and let her die. He repeated that. He actually shot her a couple more times. That was, like, kind of in her torso. And he just let her lay there and die. Several reports have mentioned the fact that he also stabbed her multiple times after the shooting. And so there's, to me, I'm like, wow, that's a lot. Like, that's overkill, man. Like, you didn't need to go that far. Like, the one headshot was probably enough. You were probably good, but you took it to the next level. And at this time when he was doing this, his grandfather, Edmund Sr., had been out. I guess he was like doing some errands, grocery shopping, what have you. And so he wasn't home at the time of his wife's murder, but he got home very shortly after. And when he got home, Edmund, before he ever even got in the house, went out and he shot his grandfather, just point blank, killed him right there. And the reason that he gave for that is, in his twisted, weird world, it was like an act of like deranged, misguided mercy. In his words, Edmund said, "I didn't want my grandfather to see his wife dead."
What a humanitarian. It's not great.
It's not great, you know? And so, but then maybe, you know, if you don't want to have him see her dead, then maybe don't kill her. You know, maybe
don't
just
kill her in the first place. I don't know. Maybe.
Stop yourself. Go for a walk, pal. Yeah, walk it off, man.
A quote from him about how he's felt about his grandmother was, "I couldn't please her. It was like being in jail. I became a walking time bomb and I finally blew." What did he ever?
Yeah,
blew
he really
all over himself. So, to quote Arrested Development. So at this point.
Oh, rest in peace, Lucille.
I know. Jessica Walter passed away recently and she was on Arrested Development and we love her a lot. So
very sad.
So he makes a call to his mom. He doesn't know what else to do. He's freaking out. He knows he's going to get found out. He doesn't know what to do. So he calls mom. In a weird way, she's there for him. Like, his dad has skipped. Yeah. His dad is gone, right? But Clarnell, in her own screwed up way, she's the go-to. As much as he hates her, that's the first person he calls when he's in need. And she says to him, and this is the right thing to do, call the cops. Well, there's nothing else to do. So he does. He calls the cops. They turn up. They see the dead grandparents. And he goes to juvie. They do an assessment on him, and he's recommended to go to Atascadero State Hospital in the criminally insane unit of that hospital.
Yes, which is a central coast town in our great golden state.
California. So he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia by court psychiatrists.
Everybody's got schizophrenia.
Apparently, at this time, everybody did.
Everybody either was like frying on LSD or had like wicked schizophrenia.
So he's in Atascadero State Hospital, and it's actually a reasonable experience for him. So he got the support of the psychiatrists and social workers who work there. And they really disagreed with what the court psychiatrists had said regarding paranoid schizophrenia. He was IQ tested. He tests at close to genius level, 136 and later 145. So regardless of how you feel about IQ tests, the fact that he's intelligent, very intelligent, is not in dispute. He was such a cooperative little inmate, and they liked him so much that he was allowed to administer psychiatric tests on other inmates.
That's amazing.
Including sex offenders. So he is just part of the gang. He later, in his prison interviews, he revealed that he kind of worked out how the tests worked. He understood the answers that you need to give. He understood what people wanted to hear you say to really feel like you were making progress and you were really working through some stuff. And he just knew what to say. He got very skilled at this kind of manipulation. He also had some conversations with sex offenders. And in this way that he continues to do of gathering information to become better at what he finally ends up doing, he learns from these sex offenders that it's better to kill a woman after raping her so that you can escape possible capture. A whole bunch of really nice people in this episode.
Yeah, everybody is a really great player.
Yeah, really. So
people you want to hang out with.
So he's released on December 18th, 1969. Actually, his birthday.
Happy birthday. His 21st birthday.
The psychiatrist at the hospital As much as he had been a model patient, they did not believe that he would be very safe to go out into the community, especially considering who he was released into the custody of.
It was the very person they said he shouldn't be released to.
It was his mom. It was Clarnell.
Here comes Clarnell.
Here comes Clarnell. And they are going to put him back in the hands of the person who has been emotionally abusing him his entire life.
Literally the root of his problem.
That's right. And the people at Atascadero really understood this. They had many conversations with him. They knew that his mom was really foundational to his unhappiness.
Yeah.
And they could not have objected more strenuously, but they were overruled and he was released.
Subsequently given back to his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so begins.
And so begins a whole lot of shit.
Yes.
So here's a quote from him about his... what his state of mind was like upon his release. I was paroled to my mother, okay? What these experts don't notice in the picture, I haven't seen it in writing anywhere, it could be somewhere, that's when I was 14 years old. I ran away from my mother. They mentioned that, okay? But if you look at that in the overall picture, why did I run away? I wanted to be with my father. That's a very topical approach to it. I wanted to get away from my mother because I was dreaming, thinking, fantasizing murder all day long. I couldn't get it out of my head. So he wanted to be with his dad. He was not able to be. He was forced to be with his grandparents. He absolutely detested his grandma, and he has now murdered both of his grandparents. These are the first two of 10 murders that he will commit before he is apprehended.
Yeah.
And now he spent several years in a mental hospital against the recommendations of the psychiatrist at the mental hospital. He has been released back to the custody of his mother, and he's just turned 21.
Yes, and at this point, she's back in California. She is working at the University of Santa Cruz in Northern California. She kind of continues with the verbal assaults, oftentimes telling him now that he's, you know, at this point, he was what? Yeah, he's 21. Like, you know, he should be going out and having a good time. He should be meeting people his own age. He should be having a blast, doing all the things that you do when you're 21. But instead, he sort of described himself as a, I think he referred to himself as like a fuddy-duddy, you know, as like an old man because he had...
old fogey.
Yeah, I think that's what it was, old fogey. He had been around quite a lot of older people while he had been in Atascadero. And so he sort of just became... kind of old.
Yeah. Acted like them.
Yeah, you know, and so he found it really hard to relate to people his own age, and he was not able to really kind of like forge a meaningful relationship. What I found very interesting is while I say that, I say this. He had met a girl at some point and become engaged to her.
This is the weirdest part of the whole
it's
thing.
Yes, it's the weirdest part. There's absolutely no information that you can find on this girl.
No. She's like a ghost.
She's like a ghost.
The weirdest
thing I would be
like,
too.
I would be. I'm like, I'm changing my
name. Keep my name out of it.
Mm-hmm. Out of your bitch mouth.
Yes.
He was just so awkward with women.
Yeah.
He could, you know, he had terrible dates. He had terrible experiences dating. And it's like all these terrible things happened, dot, dot, dot. Now he's engaged.
Exactly, like, what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And
he really addresses this. Like, how did you get engaged? What were the dates like? How did you meet her? Like, I couldn't find a thing.
Nothing. Like, zip, zero, nada. Well, apparently, the one thing I did read was that her parents had requested that her name never be used. I guess she was younger. She was a little younger. Like, I think they met while she was in high school is what it sounded like.
She was like 16, I think. Yeah, pretty
so
young.
What the fuck is he doing? Like, don't you have a parole? If you're like 21 and she's 16, that's not really like smiled upon, pal.
That's what I hear.
Yeah. So anyway, I digress and I say that he initially started to pick up these hitchhikers. Now, he had a 1969 Ford Galaxy, one of my favorites. He had gotten this car because he had been hit by a car, apparently, while on a motorcycle that he had purchased along the way. Like, there's so much of like this part of his life that like is like, what the fuck were you doing, Edmund? But anyway, apparently his arm was injured in the crash, and so he received a settlement that was like $15,000, but at the time, like, that would equate to like $90,000 today.
Yeah, you could do some stuff with
that. I'd be okay with 90 grand. I mean, I want my arms and my limbs and, you know.
But like for like a, for like, you know, a couple of weeks of pain, I would take $90,000.
I mean, if it meant me losing a toe, I, you know.
The pinky?
No, not the pinky.
The shoes.
You gotta retain the outer two for balance. And so anyway, he gets this car and now he's mobile. So he is off out and about. He has this grand idea that, you know, hey, I can't meet people my own age. I'm just going to start picking up hitchhikers. This kind of comes on the heels of he had tried out for law enforcement because he wanted to be a police officer, but was denied. He was told that he was too tall. I go back to Police Academy, the movie. We had Hightower, and that guy was easily as tall as Kemper. Anyway, because he was denied entry into any kind of law enforcement, he tended to hang out at a bar called the Jury Room. And so he just chummed it up with the local cops, and he became very good friends with most of the police force.
They called him Big Ed.
Big Ed! Just Big Ed.
Hey, look, it's Big Ed. Hey, I'll buy you a beer, Big Ed.
Exactly.
He would talk many, many hours talking about various kinds of gun and ammunition and like ballistics information. And over a long period, he kind of pumped them for information about how to not get caught. Again, he's a very manipulative person. It should be noted too that he was very obsessed with law enforcement in general. He really wanted to work in law enforcement. And so when he was denied admittance to the police force, that was very, very upsetting for him, especially because it was something that was outside of his control. And it was this thing that his whole life had been an albatross around his neck,
right?
Had been his height. It's always, you know, this thing that everyone points out to him. And once again, it gets in the way of him getting what he wants. It feeds into Clarnell's verbal abuse once again. Look at you, you're a ridiculous giant. Nobody's ever going to want to be with you. Just right into that bite. It's like the bite that fits the wound.
So all this while, he's just going on about his business. And there are hundreds of hitchhikers, apparently, that he picks up and safely takes to their destination, you know, sees them off, and they, you know, say thank you. And maybe they pitch in for some gas. Like, you know, what is your bumper sticker that says gas, ass, or grass? Nobody rides free.
Correct.
I don't know that the Galaxy had this bumper sticker. I like to think it did. But either which way, he got quite a few people safely to their destination. He was like an early Uber driver in that way. But one day, he doesn't.
One day he doesn't. And he has spent the previous months preparing himself for this moment. He starts out by driving sometimes to secluded areas and just kind of hanging out there with the girls for a while and then driving them on. He keeps a gun with him in the trunk, and then he moves it to under the seat, and then he moves it to driver's side pocket on the door. And so with each kind of successive picking up of a hitchhiker, he's doing a little bit more to kind of push himself closer to actually taking the kind of action he's fantasizing about. But at the start, he's really just sort of going through the motions and practicing and seeing what he can make himself get away with, until there's a day where he's ready to step over from fantasy into reality.
We know that he's been picking up these hitchhikers, but that's not really satisfying his itch. And we're going to move into the very short time span that he operated in, which was between May of 1972 and April of 1973. And that's when he killed the majority of his victims. So this was like 8 separate murders during this period of time. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we learned that he did was... what, Sally?
He did something. It was a new word for me, and I always like it when they discover
for all of us. It was a new word for all of us.
It was. I read it, and I knew it was going to be obscene given the context, but I wasn't sure what it was, and so I looked it up. So the word is irrematio.
Can you use irrematio in a sentence, Sally?
Let's see. Ed Kemper totally irimatioed that severed head. Irimatio, I looked it up. I will give you the direct definition. Irimatio is forced oral copulation. So it's just what it sounds like. It's usually done from a man to another person. And basically you would hold the person's head and put yon penis in yon person's mouth and forcibly copulate with it. That was fun to say. And then it has this fun name, and the name is irimatio. It's in the same word family as fellatio. Mm-hmm. So you can also have atio. I think atio means the sexy times. So here we are on our third and fourth of Ed Kemper's victims. When Ed Kemper was not killing his family members, he was looking for the kind of victim that was a person his mom would really value or see as valuable to society. When he talked about his choice of victims, he talked about who would hurt his mom the most to hear who had been killed. And so what did she value? She worked at this university. She supported these co-eds. They represented everything that he couldn't get. They represented all of the values that his mom valued. And so those were the people that he went after. I think also there's just, I mean, from a purely sexual perspective, he was a man who was attracted to females.
Yeah.
And regardless of how successful he was in his advances towards them, he was attracted to women. And these were young, beautiful, you know, healthy women.
Yeah.
They also were very, very trusting in a way that back then you really could be. Well, to a point. Not in California.
Yeah. No, certainly not in California.
No, not in California.
Never trust anyone in California.
Terrible idea. So Mary Ann Pesci and Anita Lucchesa, they were students at Fresno State College. And they were on their way to Stanford University. They'd spent a couple of days with some friends in Berkeley. And now they were going home. And what a great way to get home, just hitchhike. Mary Ann Pesci and Anita Lucchesa never got where they were going.
No.
Their parents filed missing persons reports. And what we know now is that Ed Kemper, like he had done probably many hundreds of times before, picked up these girls. And he also had something on the back of his car that was very, very helpful. So his mom was an administrative assistant, and he asked her if he could get a sticker for the back of his car that showed that he could park the car at the University of Santa Cruz. And so he kind of was driving around this car that had this sticker on the back. It kind of looked like a decommissioned police car. He was very polite. He was nice. He didn't look like the kind of guy who would do you wrong. Very open and friendly.
Yeah, he'd wave also, at you.
Give you a little of that Ed Kemper smile.
Yeah.
That wowed the ladies. Yeah. So. Because I think he was sitting down in the car as mm-hmm. well, it kind of did tip them off as to actually how large and physically imposing he was. I mean, you can tell when you get into a car if somebody's big or small.
Yeah.
But if they're sitting down, you really don't get that full impact of size.
And a Galaxy is a massive car, like you said, exactly. too. So a massive man in a massive car looks proportionate. It's not like he was driving a Beetle.
That would have been hysterical.
Oh, my God.
Like a clown car.
It totally would have been a clown car. I mean, it was because Bundy had it and he was a pretty big clown.
He was a giant clown. So he gets Mary Ann and Anita and he gets them into his car. They are kind of trusting and he starts driving them around. And eventually he kind of gets to an area that's very quiet and very deserted. And he pulls out his gun and tells them that they're going to do what he says or he'll kill them. He gets Anita out and he puts her in the trunk of his car. While she's there, he's able to work on Mary Ann.
Yeah.
He handcuffs Mary Ann. He puts her in the back seat face down, puts a plastic bag over her head, and tries to strangle her with a piece of cloth. She's clever and she bites a hole in the bag, and the cloth snapped. So he's super frustrated by this. Ed Kemper is very much driven by frustration and rage, and so this really enrages him that she does this. He pulls out a knife that he's got, he stabs her repeatedly, and finally he slashes her throat.
And all the while, her friend is in the trunk and can hear her friend being killed.
Literally just on the other side.
On the other side. And yeah.
You know, like 2 feet of her.
So the screaming, the chaos, the wrestling around, and then all of a sudden it's just...
stops and everything
dead
goes
silence.
Still. So he now knows it's time to go and take care of Anita. Anita is a real scrappy fighter. And he notes this. It's so noteworthy that he talks about it in several of his interviews. And I really like Anita, and I wish that she had been able to survive. I mean, I wish they all had.
Yeah.
But something I love, the scrappy ones are the ones that really break my heart the most. So she really fights him. And he talks about even after he has stabbed her several times, she's still fighting with, like, you know, that last kind of, this is it, I have to get out of this or I'm going to die, kind of the last bit of strength in your body. Finally, he wears her down. That's almost inevitable given their comparative sizes. And she gets weaker and weaker, and finally she passes away in the back of his car, trying to decide what his next move is. He drives around for a while with these bodies in the car. Marianne's in the trunk, Anita's in the backseat. He's a little freaked out that he's done this, even though he's been mentally preparing himself to do it for months and months. He brings Marianne's body into his apartment first, and he undresses her and he dissects her, just takes her apart. And then he also beheads Anita's body and he dissects her in the same way. He wraps the parts of both of the girls. Marianne's body was in the same plastic bag that he used to try to suffocate her. He keeps their heads for several days. He does irrematio. He also talks to them. He also takes them to bed with him. They are kind of companions. And eventually he disposes of the heads the same place that he disposes of their body.
Yeah, it's the Loma Prieta Mountains.
Marianne's body and her head were found unidentified, but Anita's head and her body were never discovered.
So he kind of took the summer off. I don't know why he took this much time off, but he skipped over a couple of months. And then September 4th of 1972, there was a young girl, she was 15 years old, a dance student who had decided to hitchhike after missing her bus. Her name was Aiko Ku. She unfortunately had the bad luck of hitchhiking and getting picked up by Edmund Kemper. He picked her up. He decided to take her and drive around, and he ended up in a remote area, and this time pulls a gun. Somehow, some way, had been outside of the car and locked himself out of the car. For whatever reason, Aiko decided to let him back in the car. This could be simply because she was 15, mm-hmm. scared shitless, didn't know what to do, probably mm-hmm. didn't know how to drive, so was just like, what the fuck? At this point, he's now back in the car, and then he ends up manually strangling her until she's unconscious, and then he proceeds to rape and kill her. The rape thing with him is really interesting. It seemed like that wasn't his driving force, wasn't to rape them. It did happen, and mm-hmm. with the sexual component to his crimes.
But never when they were alert.
Or alive, much like his teacher that he would have had to kill before he kissed her. And so, you know, that's why I brought that up, because it was just such an interesting precursor that nobody could have really ever thought would have ever come to this. But he keeps her body with him after she's dead, and he goes to a bar where he has a couple of drinks, I guess maybe to calm his nerves. As you do, you know, he's got a body in the car, no big deal, just going to have a couple of drinks and take the edge off of what I just did. He later confessed, though, that after he was finished at the bar and having a good time, he actually opened up the trunk of his car and gazed upon this young girl who he just killed, who was laying there dead in the trunk of the Galaxy. He then proceeds to take her back to his apartment, has sexual intercourse with a corpse. I have a hard time with that. It's just, I can't, it doesn't roll off the tongue. After he's done, he goes to his same old, where he proceeds to dismember and dispose of Ku's remains.
Except for her head.
Except for her head, of course, right? You know, her poor mother, you know, she's trying to find her daughter. Nobody knows where she is. They don't have any information to give her. You know, she's passing out flyers left and right, and there's just no information on her whatsoever. And, you know, meanwhile, Edmund has dismembered her and is about to dispose of parts of her, except for her head.
Except for her head. And to give you a sense for how just straight out audacious he is, the day after he kills Aikoku, he is going before this panel of psychiatrists to make the argument that his record of killing his grandparents should be expunged. It was kind of this like follow-up that he was required to do. And they noticed that he'd done well in school. He'd stayed out of trouble. He was such a manipulator. He knew what they wanted to hear. He knew what to say. The first doctor said he could not see any reason to consider that Kemper would be a danger to anybody. The second doctor actually said these words, normal, safe. And they both recommended that the juvenile records be sealed so that it wouldn't affect his ongoing life and he could become a better citizen. And even as this was happening, and Kemper's car is in the parking lot outside with this girl's severed head in the trunk. Even as the psychiatrists are patting themselves on the back for having rehabilitated this kid and safely letting him out into society where he will do good now that his record has been expunged. And in the meantime, the woman he just, this young woman that he just killed, her head is in his trunk. I got nothing. It's just awful. And it really shows you he's not doing stuff like writing letters to the cops and taunting them, but there is a level of kind of like, look what I can get away with.
Look at me hanging out in plain sight at the jury room, I think is what it was called, making pals and chumming it up with all of the fellow officers. Nobody's going to suspect me, which comes into play a little later. But it's totally true. You know, he's just so manipulative and like plotting and just methodical about that aspect of it. It's absolutely terrifying when you think about it, how he was just able to, you know, be one way around certain people and then just be this monster, his true self.
His true self. And that I think that's easy to think of Ed Kemper as the true guy and then this monstrous other personality as this alternate personality. But the way a lot of them speak about themselves is that that is the real them.
Mm-hmm. They are one and the same.
Right. And then like the outer is just like a mask that they put on. But it's pretty fascinating. I do find this fascinating. The fact that you can have these, essentially these two minds, this mind that is able to exist in the world and get its needs met, and this other self that is just so dark and twisted and violent and angry. And the fact that those two beings can coexist, like this is the thing I find fascinating about Ted Bundy, is that, you know, when you look at him in court, and, you know, he's this very calm, urbane, well-spoken, polite, almost charming. I think he's gross, but almost charming.
His turtlenecks.
Oh, the turtle. I know. You're not a big fan. But then you think about, like, the Chi Omega murders and how he just went through that sorority house like a wood chipper in, like, the space of 15 minutes. And the level of ferocious intensity that you have to bring to that. And you've got these two people essentially coexisting.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing to me that that can happen. It's a statement about how complicated our brains are and how the wiring can allow us to become essentially different people. Ugh. Aiko makes me really sad. She's from a Korean family and her family adore her and she's a graceful, beautiful dancer and she just wants to get home. And then she meets Ed Kemper and she never does.
You know, and it's the same thing that, like we talked about in the Fred and Rose West episode, you know, just don't fucking, if you're at a bus stop, just wait for the bus.
Call your mom and dad.
Yeah. It might have been a little harder back then in the, you know, whenever, 70s, because, you know, they don't have that luxury of the cell phone, right? Just don't get in the car. Please. We are pleading with you guys.
Please.
Don't do it.
I feel like now we know so much better. Hitchhiking is not really a thing anymore.
It's not. And I'll tell you, every time I see somebody, you know, and they've got, you know, a sign, like if I get off the freeway or I'm getting on the freeway, whatever the case is, and they're like, you know, San Francisco or bust or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't fucking know. Whatever the case is, my first thought is, yeah, I'm going to pick you up so you can kill me. I know I'm not going to kill you, but I don't trust that you're not going to kill me and steal everything I have and leave me rotting in my car somewhere.
It's bad either way. Like, I've seen a couple of women hitchhiking. I don't say it very often. I've seen it like twice in my whole life. And I think to myself, how is this possibly going to end well for you?
Kemper can't ignore these certain crimes of opportunity.
And so here we've got number six. Number six in Ed Kemper's Reign of Terror is Cynthia Ann Shaw. She sometimes goes by Cindy. So we're going to call her Cindy because that's what she goes as. Now into 1973, which is the last year that Ed Kemper will see freedom.
Yes.
So on January 7th, he picks up Cindy Shaw. She's 18. She's a student. And like all of these people are co-eds. And he drives to this wooded area and he shoots her with a .22 caliber pistol. The quick manner of death is one of the few things that we can be glad for, especially considering what came later.
Yeah.
So she was killed with a single shot to the head from his gun. He kept her body in a cupboard that night, waiting for mom to go to work. Presumably, that's not a cupboard that mom opens very frequently.
Yeah.
And as soon as she leaves for work, he takes out her body and he decapitates it in what is now becoming something that's very familiar to him. He uses a very large knife for this purpose. He also, because of all his time hanging out with the cops and talking about ballistics and crime scenes and all this sort of thing, he does something that he hasn't done before, and that is he considers the bullet fragments that are in Cindy Shaw's head, and he realizes that somebody might be able to link it back to his gun at some point in the future. So he actually digs bullet fragments out of her skull, and then he keeps them for a little while as a nice trophy.
Yeah, and he did his thing where he performed irrematio that he's become extremely familiar with. So his hatred of his mother ran so deeply that he took this girl's head and planted it in the yard underneath his mother's window, face up, because she always wanted people to look up to her.
And it's just grisly.
In his twisted mind, this made all the sense in the world. And I have to think of this particular thing, like him just digging that hole and like all vengeful about it, placing the severed head in this hole facing up. You know, here you go. You know, that's all I can imagine. How he didn't get caught, though, because he lived in a neighborhood. So I do not understand how he didn't ever get busted for this by somebody. Somebody had to have seen something.
You would think so.
Either which way, he buries Cindy's head. And then he continued the dismemberment, and he disposed of it by throwing them off of a cliff somewhere in California.
The parts of her were found, actually. She was murdered January 7th. On January 10th, her arms and her hands were found. On January 17th, her torso was found. On January 19th, her left hand was found. On January 27th, her pelvis was found.
Apparently, they determined that she had been cut into pieces with a power saw.
Oh my god. Jeez. It's just so gnarly.
How do you clean that, though?
I don't know. Doesn't it all get up inside of it? Like,
I would think that that would not be an easy tool to clean body fragments. I'm not trying to be disgusting, but
it must be some kind of way. Question mark? Probably not going to investigate that one.
Yeah, I'm definitely not going to try to find that one out firsthand.
No.
Oh, that pun. Yeah.
So he buried her head in his backyard, and it will not be the last severed head.
No, it won't.
That he buries in her backyard. His backyard. Well, both of their backyards.
Their backyard.
His mom lived there too.
Yeah.
Yeah, the having her staring upwards at his mom's window.
The symbolism.
Just another level of screwed up. That was Cynthia Shaw, and now we're on to 7 and 8.
Yes, who are Rosalind Thorpe and Allison Liu. On February 5th of 1973, so now he's really escalating, right? His time frame is starting to shrink. before it was May, and then it was September, and then from September it was to January, but now it's January to February, not even a month, because it was January 7th and now we're at February 5th. So that he has a fight with his mom, you know, as they do, and he just decides that he is gonna, you know, go out, and he picks up Rosalind Heather Thorpe. She was 20, and Alice Helen, or Allison Lou, at the UCSC campus. So this car was a coupe, and so somebody had to get into the back seat, right? And so this person who got into the back seat was extra fucked, and this particular person was Thorpe. Thorpe got in first, and then she kind of reassured her friend to get in, and it kind of seemed like Lou was kind of a little bit skeptical of it. Like, she wasn't really having it. And of course, this is Kemper's recounting of this, but it seemed like she was definitely like a little bit more skeptical of things. At this point, he does his kind of like got his formula right. And so he does a thing. He shoots them with the .22.
While he's driving.
Yeah.
That's new. He's like, he's driving along and he's like, oh, look out there at that thing over there.
Yeah,
and like,
exactly.
They turn their head, and as she turns her head and she looks away, he tells her to look away, you know, essentially look over there. And then he shoots her in the back of the head. And the girl on the back is obviously freaking out, and he turns and he shoots her several times too. She doesn't die immediately, but as soon as he can pull over to a quiet spot, he turns around and he shoots her fatally.
Yeah. And what's really ironic about this is we go back to what you had said a little while ago about that sticker that he had on his car, because now people were noticing these girls are disappearing. There are body parts being found. There is something really bad happening out there. And so the girls and other hitchhikers, mostly the females, though, because that's what they had been finding remains of, had been advised to only accept rides from cars with university stickers on them, which he had. So it was like all roads led back to Ed Kemper on this. Mm-hmm. Like, no matter what, it was all, he was winning with what he was trying to do. And so because he had this sticker on his car, it was a little bit more like, okay, you're one of us. Like, I'll just
you're
get
one
in.
Of us. Yeah. You're one of the team.
I'll trust you because, you know, you're part of the family. He then brings the bodies after he had shot them and wrapped them in the blankets. He brings these bodies, of course, back to his mother's house. He proceeds to decapitate them in his car, which I have no clue how the fuck you clean that up.
They eventually pulled the seats out of the Galaxy, and there was just a swamp of blood underneath.
But the smell, the odor, like, ugh.
I cannot imagine
that, that.
I know. I can't even imagine.
Exactly. It's. Anyway, I'm sorry.
We could write to him and tell him because he's still alive. We could ask him. Oh, did your car smell?
I am sure he'd be happy to talk about it too.
Sorry for interrupting. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. So after he beheads them in his car, I don't know how he did this exactly, but he evidently carried the headless corpses back into his mom's house, and he proceeded to be intimate with the corpses.
He's very intimate with them.
Both of the corpses. And then he moved on to his next move, which was dismembering the bodies. Now, like you had mentioned before, the last time with the ballistics and everything, he removed the bullets to prevent the identification of his gun and discarded their remains the next morning. He's becoming more proficient at this point. He's becoming better at the work that he's doing. He's faster. Like, the first murder was sloppy by his own account. You know, he didn't know what he was doing. It was really disorganized. Now he's got kind of what works for him in this way.
It does. The only problem is that the need is escalating.
And yes.
This is something that we see time and time again with serial killers. And they start out so, so, so careful. And then, as just like any addiction, you have to increase the dosage or you don't get the hit. I think with these two at the end, something changed and he realized that he wasn't ever going to be able to stop. So we're getting to sort of the climax, if you will, of the story. But before we go too much further, I want to just take a little quick dive into something that we've talked about previously, but is very, very much relevant in this case. And that's objectification. when you are doing something really horrible to a person, the less you can view them as a person with feelings and thoughts, and the more that you can view them as an object, really aids you in your process. Ed Kemper absolutely viewed these people and their decapitated heads as objects for his pleasures. So here are some quotes directly from Ed Kemper that kind of embody this idea of objectification and how it applies to him. "If I killed them, you know, they couldn't reject me as a man. It was more or less making a doll out of a human being and carrying out my fantasies with a doll, a living human doll." Who does that remind you of, Keita?
Jeffrey Dahmer.
"I remember it was very exciting. There was actually a sexual thrill. It was kind of an exalted, triumphant type thing, like taking the head of a deer or an elk or something that would be to a hunter. I was the hunter and they were the victims."
You know, it's really interesting, the connection as far as like, who does that sound like? Because the way Jeffrey Dahmer spoke about his crimes, if you listen to episode 17, is very much the same way that Edmund Kemper speaks about his crimes. Very open. He's kind of like, go ahead and ask away. I will tell you what you want to know. And even right up until after they, each of them was caught, you know, they were both kind of like, yep, okay, it's time. There was no fighting it. You know, it's like when you look at somebody like Ted Bundy, the showmanship at the trial and like the multiple escapes and all the things of just trying to like, you know, pretend that he was innocent. These two are just like, yep, no, we did it. We totally did it. And you know what? You want to know why? Go ahead and ask away. Mm-hmm.
The difference I feel, although you're right, they're absolutely so similar, is that Dahmer was so reluctant. He knew he had to talk about himself. He was so reluctant to do it. Like, it was horrible for him.
He was. Yeah, yeah.
But Kemper just reveled in it. But they both were very forthcoming about the crimes. Mm-hmm. So here's a quote that was from the murder of Aiko Ku, that young 15-year-old dancer. So this is what he says. "I suppose as I was standing there looking, I was doing one of those triumphant things too, admiring my work and admiring her beauty. And I might say, admiring my catch like a fisherman. When they were being killed, there wasn't anything going on in my mind except that they were going to be mine. That was the only way they could be mine." Remember, if I kiss her, I'll have to kill her?
Yeah.
"Oh, what is it like to have sex with a dead body? What does it feel like to sit on your living room couch and look over and see two decapitated girls' heads on the arm of the couch? The first time, it makes you sick to your stomach. The head trip fantasies were a bit like a trophy. You know, the head is where everything is at. The brain, eyes, mouth, that's the person. I remember being told as a kid, you cut off the head and the body dies. The body is nothing after the head is cut off. Well, that's not quite true. There's a lot left in the girl's body without the head. Of course, the personality is gone." The personality being gone, again, with like just right with Dahmer, that idea of like a living doll. So nobody can object. Nobody can reject you. Nobody can say no to you. It's like ultimate possession. And he talks about that very honestly, about wanting to dominate and have them and make them be his. And the wording he uses is reminds me a lot of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yeah. You know, and these two, so far as I know, they never ever knew one another or talked to each other. I mean, they were in two different facilities by the time it was all said and done anyway. Mm-hmm. But just the fact that they have certain parallels in their lives, you know, Dahmer with the abandonment, all of the things that made that up. And then with Kemper, like the rejection, you know, of his mother, and how, you know, she was always telling him how he was never going to be good enough for these girls, and how, you know, no girl would ever like him. And so it's just kind of like this poison that is in his brain about himself.
His method takes liking completely out of the equation. It doesn't matter if they like him.
Exactly. So much like how Jeffrey Dahmer, they could never leave. In this way, with Kemper, it didn't make a difference if he was liked or not. While they're not the same thing, there are certain things between the two that really kind of are eerily similar.
A lot of overlap, for sure. Well, this takes us to really where this whole thing was going right from the start. Murder number 9 and murder number 10 are very closely linked. Number 10 is almost incidental
Mm-hmm.
But number nine is the key point here. Number nine is the killing of his own mother, Clarnell. So on April 20th, 1973, she comes home from a party. She was an alcoholic for most of her life, if we haven't already mentioned that. That doesn't usually make you always the most emotionally stable person.
Mm-hmm.
And she's already kind of wobbly there to begin with. Mm-hmm. But she's been to a party. She comes home and she wakes up Ed coming home.
As you do when you're drunk.
When you're drunk, you're kind of stumbling around and banging into the wall and stuff. Yeah. Or maybe that's just me. I don't know. So Ed goes to her room. She's gotten into bed. She's reading a book. And she sees him come to the room. She says, "I suppose you're going to want to sit up all night and talk now." And Kemper replies, "Nope. Good night." And he turns and walks out of the room. He's just totally filled with rage at this point. He talks a lot about his rage, and we'll get to it in a little bit in terms of his motivations here. It really was an all-consuming thing for him. It came to a point, and this was just the night where it all came together for him. So he waits for Clarnell to fall asleep, and he goes to her bedroom, and he bludgeons her to death with a claw hammer. And to seal the deal, he slits her throat with a knife.
Ooh, that is a nasty way to die.
That's a nasty way to die. It was probably a very quick way to die. I mean, I can't imagine that too many blows to the head with a claw hammer from a 6'9", 300-pound man is really going to have you last that long. We can at least hope for her sake. Then, in keeping with his pattern so far, he decapitates his mother. He does perform irrematio on her severed head. He takes her severed head downstairs and he puts it on a shelf and he screams at it for about an hour. Just all the things he's always wanted to say to his mom. He also throws darts at it. So he's really going for the humiliation. Even though she can't experience humiliation anymore, this is almost cathartic for him.
Oh, to be a fly on the wall for that.
Oh, to be a fly. Can you imagine the conversation that he had with that head? That would have been very interesting.
Yeah.
The next thing that he does, this is pretty horrible, but at this point...
It's what you're here for, people.
So here we go. It's what you're here for. So he smashes her face in. That's his own words. He smashed her face in. He cut out her tongue. And her larynx. The larynx is a very gristly part of the body. Vocal cords are pretty strong cords, I guess is the right word there. And so he decides to put it down the garbage disposal and turns the garbage disposal on, but the garbage disposal can't chunk through it and it spits it right back into the sink. He says later, "That seemed appropriate. As much as she'd bitched and screamed and yelled at me over so many years." Metaphoric. So he does this to his mom. He humiliates her corpse. He screams at it. He yells at it. He bashes her face in. He rips out her vocal cords. He rips out her tongue. He's just going hog wild on this woman's body. And all of his rage and all of his hatred just pour out of him. And this is kind of a pinnacle moment in his life.
It's where it was all leading.
It's where it was all leading, and this is now where we find ourselves. So it's now the morning of the next day, and he's just sitting at his house. It passes into afternoon, and he doesn't know what to do. In his kind of slightly shell-shocked state, given that he just murdered his own mother... He thinks to himself, well, if somebody else was found dead along with my mother, then suspicion somehow may not point towards me. I'm not quite sure how that logic pans out.
Yeah.
But anyway, so what he does is he calls a lady named Sarah Hallett, who is a friend of Clarnell's. They're very good buddies. And he invites her to dinner. He says that it's a surprise for his mom, and she calls him back because he'd left her a message and says, "I'd love to come to dinner. I'll see you there at 5:00 so she turns up. He lets her into the house, shuts the door, and he immediately strangles her.
Like chokehold, like in the crook of his arm. Mm-hmm. You know, Sarah Hallett is also known as Sally Hallett. So if we refer to her as Sarah or Sally, that's why.
How he describes this, lifting her up in the crook of his arm.
I mean, he's a massive man, and I don't know how small this woman was. I have to think she was nowhere near his size.
No.
But
no, certainly. This is a quote from him about the killing of Sarah / Sally Hallett. I squeezed and I just lifted her off the floor. She just hung there, and for a moment I didn't realize she was dead. I had broken her neck, and her head was just wobbling around with the bones of her neck disconnected in the skin sack of her neck.
Skin sack. I read that too, and I was like,
it's shuddered.
But
so yeah,
the term skin sack.
I know, skin sack. There's only one part of the human anatomy where I use
think of sack.
Sack, and it's not your neck. Certainly not. So he has now killed this poor woman who had no part in this at all. I mean, none of them did, but you know, she was just there to create some kind of super dodgy and not at all believable alibi.
She's like, I thought you were having me over for dinner.
So now shit is really hitting the fan. He has killed his mom and done horrible things to her body. He has killed his mom's friend. He actually does do horrible things to her body as well, including having sex with it.
Yes.
And then on Easter Sunday morning, he kind of panics and he's like, I gotta get out of town. So he leaves in Sarah's car, Sarah / Sally's car, and he starts driving east. Then he rents another car and he drops off Sarah's car at a gas station and tells the gas station attendant, oh, it needs repairs. I'll come back for it in a day. But he just kind of abandons it there and he drives the rental. And he drives and he drives and he drives and he drives. For like 18 hours, he drives nonstop in this kind of like borderline panic.
Taking caffeine pills. From Pueblo, Colorado to Northern California, it's easily 1,000 miles.
It's not more. It's a long ass way.
Not more. I've driven that drive to Southern California from Colorado several times, and it's in long time.
Yeah, so he's popping the no-dos like it's M&M's. So he's got the radio on and he is absolutely expecting to hear all about this murder of these two, you know, older women. And he's not hearing anything. It's completely baffling to him. And he's feeling like he's about to get arrested, like this is about to all fall apart. And the tension is really just ratcheting up. He's already on a knife edge of instability and panic and I wouldn't say guilt, but a lot of feelings directed at himself about worrying about his freedom and what's going to happen next. And should he just end it? Should he just kill himself? And he's completely emotionally, physically exhausted.
Yeah, well, 1,000-mile drive on fucking no-dos, it'll do that to you.
And I think if you put that as like the icing on the cake.
Coming off of two major murders,
coming off of this like huge emotional event that has happened in his life.
Yeah.
You know, killing the person who was responsible for really making him who he was.
Right.
This marathon drive and things just come to a head for him and he decides he can't do it anymore. At one point, because he's got three guns and a knife in the car, he has this idea that he is going to die via suicide by cop. And he felt that he was going to need to be killed or he would keep on killing. And so he was kind of expecting there to be a showdown and that would just kind of be the end of it. But the bodies hadn't been found. And he's still just in a state of panic and exhaustion and just mental overwhelm. And it's too much. And he decides to stop it all.
It's so interesting to me how history sort of repeats itself for a second time with the murders of his grandparents, how he turned himself in for that, and how he's about to do it again. But now for like the murder of his mother, his mother's friend, and all the co-eds.
And this drive to kill has just kind of left him, like, because really all of those murders and all of those women who had been killed were really kind of like a trial run.
That, exactly.
And now he had completed it. And there's a quote from him and it goes like this. The original purpose was gone. It wasn't serving any physical or real or emotional purpose. It was just a pure waste of time. Emotionally, I couldn't handle it much longer. Toward the end there, I started feeling the folly of the whole damn thing, and at the point of near exhaustion, near collapse, I just said, to hell with it, and I called it all off. He goes to a phone booth. He places a call to the Santa Cruz Police Department from where he is in Pueblo, Colorado. And he confesses, and he says, I have killed my mother and her friend, Sally Hallett. And they don't believe him. At first, they didn't believe him. Like, oh, Ed, you jokester.
Oh, Big Ed. It's just Big Ed being Big Ed again.
Oh, you crazy guy.
Yeah.
And so they actually kind of hang up on him. He ends up having to call back. And he calls back and he asks to speak directly to one of the officers that he has a closer relationship with through their many conversations at the jury room bar. Confesses again. And he's able to convince him. He says, I have killed my mother and I have killed her friend, Sally Hallett. They're at my mother's house and you can find them there.
Yeah, he's describing also too some of the crimes that he committed against the co-eds. They don't always release everything that they know in the media. That's one way to weed out people who falsely confess. And he knew certain details to certain cases that just weren't released out into the public yet. And we're like, oh, fuck.
So the police turn up and he is at the phone booth where he called them. He's arrested in Pueblo, Colorado for the murder of his mother and her friend, Sally Hallett. He's later convicted of 8 counts of first degree murder. He gave a very detailed confession. He described exactly each person. It turns out he has a spectacular memory.
Well, that big old IQ, what do you expect?
Well, exactly. That big old 140-something IQ.
Yeah.
Gotta do something good with it.
Right.
So he gives a very detailed confession. And so his lawyer really only has one choice in his defense, and that is to plead not guilty by reason of insanity to those murder charges.
Yeah.
That defense failed. And Kemper tried twice to commit suicide while he was in custody.
Uh-huh.
At his sentencing, he actually asked for the death penalty. He requested, and I quote, death by torture.
I don't think that that's on the table.
Yeah, they're not going to do that just because you asked.
Yeah, I mean, and plus too, I mean, California, we don't kill anybody that we say we're going to kill. So what's really interesting about him being on death row or wanting the death penalty, Herbie Muller was another spree killer, I guess, who mm-hmm. was operating in the same area, very close to the same time frame as Ed Kemper was. And they ended up being neighbors in prison. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to kill Herbert Mullen because he felt that it would essentially, like, why are people paying for the two of them to be in prison? Like, he's so weirdly, coldly logical about certain things and so removed and devoid of like the emotion where he's just kind of like, well, you know, like, you know, I might as well die by torture and, you know, I might as well kill Herbert Mullen because if I kill Herbert Mullen, that's kind of like two birds with one stone and then I kill myself and, you know, cool.
During his trial, his youngest sister, Alan Kemper, who was 22 at the time, she actually was being cross-examined, and she stated that both she and her mom at one point thought that Ed might have been involved in Cynthia Schall's death. If you remember, Cynthia Schall was the one who they found lots of parts of her body over the course of January of that year. Alan Kemper also testified that at one point she had asked Ed directly whether he had had anything to do with that killing. And his response, this is a quote, "No, but I was afraid you might be suspicious because of that cat thing, i.e. torturing cats in our childhood together. My mother has already asked me about it, and I'd appreciate if you didn't bring it up again because it would just stir things up." So he was convicted of 8 counts of first-degree murder. He was given consecutive life sentences instead of the death by torture that he requested. So Edmund Kemper is still alive. He is currently serving his time at California Medical Facility State Prison in Vacaville, California.
It sounds so welcoming when you say it like that.
Well, Sunday, it does.
Yeah, it really does.
He's in Gen Pop, yeah, right? Yeah, who just thought?
And considered to be a model prisoner.
Who's going to mess with him?
I mean, but right? Seriously.
If you are going to find people to mess with you, like, prison is the place to find them. But seriously, like, I just don't think he gets messed with.
I wouldn't think so. You know, it's interesting because, once again, going into how he kind of fit into the fabric of the society that he lived in, you know, he was so able to insert himself and just be normal amongst people. He's kind of like that from what it sounds like in prison. Guards seem to like him. He mm-hmm. seems to get along relatively well with other inmates. Like you said, who's going to mess with him? He's been like a full-blown model prisoner this whole entire time, with the exception of one time, I think it was just a couple of years ago, where he refused to give up a urine sample. I don't know why. He doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who's, like, you know, real into drugs or anything, but he didn't do that, and that was his very first infraction while he's been in prison, which was a very long time. It's over, you know, almost 50 years that he's been in prison.
God, that's such a long time.
He apparently makes, as part of his way of, like, I don't know, being a model prisoner, he makes these really, I've seen pictures of them, they're actually really beautiful ceramic cups, coffee cups.
Oh my God.
And
can you buy them? Is he a little Etsy store?
I don't know. I might buy one if he did. I would buy you one.
Can you imagine? made by the hands
of Ed Kemper. He was also something that I thought was really interesting was, he's also a very good reader. He read audiobooks for blind people, which was like, wow, that's a that's a big step.
I mean, several hundred audiobooks.
It doesn't really erase what you've done, sir, but it also is kind of like, that's actually sort of cool. And I think there's a website that you can go on to. I think it's like Edmund Kemper Books or something like that, and you can actually listen. That's not it exactly, but it's something like that, and you can listen to the audiobooks that he's read.
Apparently his the recording of him reading Flowers in the Attic.
Ooh, that's already a creepy ass book.
Right? Apparently, like, the recording of him reading that went viral a few years ago.
You know, I used to love me some V.C. Andrews.
Mm-hmm. Creepy, creepy, creepy.
Oh, yeah. So he has a stepbrother who hates him. Yeah, and rightly so. I guess in his family, Edmund Kemper III was also called Guy. I don't know where this came from. I don't know what it's short for. But apparently, in addition to being Edmund, he was also known by some of the people in his family as Guy. And this brother, who gave an interview not that long ago, actually, really, his level of disdain for him goes so far as to say, and I quote from this article, "I would want to kill him on the spot. It would be doing society and mankind a favor. As a Christian, I would not forgive him. I would tell him to go to hell where he belongs."
You can feel the hate.
On the flip side, his two sisters, so Susan passed away, Alan is still alive, but they kind of regarded him as a good person who had done bad things. That one's a little tough to swallow for me.
It's a little tough to swallow. Kind of like a larynx down.
Just like that garbage disposal felt.
Exactly.
Yeah, his sister Susan actually passed away in 2013. I'm not exactly sure why, what happened there, but this brother also says, "It irritates me. Personally, I think that if someone is glorifying a sicko like Guy, they are showing signs of a warped mind and should be locked up for observation. Overall, it disgusts us. There needs to be less people fantasizing being like him. I blame society. It's crazy. I think we are too far lenient on criminals. What I do know is the vast majority of them could have been picked out in a room while they were kids. A sociopath, like a psychopath, is incurable. They begin showing signs at an early age. If we were to put them away as soon as they start showing signs, we'd have a healthier, safer society as a whole.
Can't disagree.
But he's also talking about imprisoning children, so that's,
yeah, and
that's
like,
the tough part about that statement.
You know, and the thing is, like, potential doesn't mean that you will. It just means potential. And this idea that people are just, you know, you can tell as a child that they're going to do these things, it's like, a lot of children are abused, I'm very sad to say. It doesn't mean they grow up to be serial killers.
Yeah.
A lot of children even perform cruelty to animals when they're little and they don't grow up to be killers. In fact, some of them grow up when they're like horrified by what they did when they were little.
Yeah, and it was maybe like a really bad phase that a kid was going through because they were curious. And actually, I just looked it up in this person. He goes by the name of David Weber, not his real name. He's actually his half-brother.
He's the half-brother. David Weber. Yeah. Well, you know, I don't blame him for that rage for, you know, at all. I mean, he's probably, you know, inexorably altered the course of David Weber's life.
So he has had numerous parole hearings while he's been incarcerated. Every one of them has obviously been denied, and he's waived quite a few of them as well. And I think that it's extremely unlikely at this point. I think he's like 72 at this point, and he's never going to get out of prison. I think his next parole hearing is actually in 2024. So, you know, he may not even survive to see that next parole hearing.
Mm-hmm. His exact words were, "Society is not ready in any way, shape, or form for me, and I can't fault them for that." Well, Ed Kemper continues to fascinate us, even though his crimes were committed almost 50 years ago. So many elements make him compelling. His immense physical size, the nature of his murders and his postmortem explorations, his clarity of thought and expression, and his ability to self-reflect with almost brutal honesty about himself and his motivations. Ed Kemper's actions are inextricably bound up with his dysfunctional relationship with his mother. Her death extinguished his need to kill. "The original purpose was gone," he said. "It was just a pure waste of time." Kemper committed brutal crimes, and that doesn't make him unusual. However, there's one thing about him that makes him rare. He's a captured serial killer who's willing to talk. He has Bundy's verbal abilities, but without the self-delusion. He has Dahmer's proclivities, but unlike Dahmer, Ed Kemper wants to share his thoughts and compulsions. And that verbosity has allowed us some glimpses into his character. In a twisted way, he considers this a public service. "Maybe they can study me," he said, "and find out what makes people like me do the things they do." You've been listening to Homicide Worldwide. What a great way to get home, just to hitchhike.
Right. And as we all know, hitchhiking always goes great.
Super, super well. Also, helping somebody move a sofa into a van also never goes poorly. It's just always successful. That's glorious.
Thank you.